Thank you, Dennis. Well, when you first told me how much time I had, I drafted out what I wanted to say. I was just waiting for the restless to. What I wanted to say, and then two things happened to that. One is a really informative talks yesterday, which gave me more material. And, of course, our president-elect, who continuously gives me more material. Fortunately for you and for me, I didn't read his tweets of the morning. But two things that I wanted to say. One is, the title of my talk is called The Bullying Pulpit. Now, the bullying pulpit is really a takeoff on the bully pulpit, which was coined by Teddy Roosevelt in 1912. And it refers to a public office or position of authority that provides its occupant with an outstanding opportunity to speak out on any issue. I now changed it to the bullying pulpit, giving the current occupant of the pulpit. But in any event, Francis Fukuyama, in his 1992 book, The End of History, made the claim that what we may be witnessing is not just the end of the Cold War or the passing of a particular period of history as such, but the end of history as such, that is, the end point of mankind's ideological evolution and the universality of Western liberal democracy as the final form of human government. Well, it reminds me of my favorite Nietzsche quote, "The lack of a sense of history is a genetic defense, the genetic defect of philosophers." I blew that one past my wife last week, and she said, "Well, how many Nietzsche quotes do you have?" Wives can be very annoying. But the political mind, including apparently Fukuyama's, attempts to confine unpleasant things to the past. Human progress does not move up, if it moves up at all, in a straight line. Darwin was right, but he knew that human beings and human evolution involve a lot more than standing upright and making tools. We tend to see the 20th century, for example, as providing great scientific and medical advances and lessening the poverty around the world, but sometimes we forget about the genocide and other dehumanizing events representing, in the 20th century, an anthropological backslide. As reflected in the introductory papers to this workshop, people across Europe and the United States, or at least segments of people, are demonstrating their discontent and disenchantment with the ideals and institutions which are the very foundation of our contemporary Western societies. And nowhere is this more evident than in the United States, where we have just elected perhaps the least qualified candidate in American history, a narcissist, a desensitizing bully, who has neither political principles nor constructive policies. But Trump's deepest hostility and his appeal was directed against those elitist traitors within America who coddle minorities and despise the real people. But his victory does represent a working class rebellion, white middle class resentment against the elites from the East and West Coast, and those generally intent in making big change in draining the swamp. And if I may, it reminds me of The Wizard of Oz. An allegory, the theme of The Wizard of Oz, written in the 1900s and representing the economic conditions and the political conditions and the social conditions of the 1890s, and perhaps of today as well. It can add the images and the characters resemble the political images of the 1890s and today. First, we had the scarecrow, the subsistence farmer, the tin man always needing oiling, the factory worker, the cowardly lion, other beleaguered bottom half of our society. And then there's Dorothy, the naive, young, and simple representative of the American people. She is every man, led astray and seeking her way back home. Following the road of gold leads her eventually to the Emerald City, which symbolically is the fraudulent world of money and politics, which pretends to have values. It is ruled by a scheming politician, the wizard, and it gets better. He uses publicity devices and tricks to fool the people into believing he is benevolent, wise, and powerful, when really he's an evil and selfish humbug. He sends Dorothy into severe danger, hoping she will rid him of his enemy, the Wicked Witch. See, it does get better. It turns out, of course, that he is nothing more than a weak man hiding behind a curtain. The issue is whether Trump and his followers represent a true challenge to the liberal values incorporated in our Constitution. Rage against the elite, unabashed nativism, economic protectionalism, so appalling to the educated and affluent Americans, and which offended many minorities. Nonetheless, reflect the same cry and pain and demand for change that seems to be bundling Britain out of the EU. Trump understands his audience and draws his strength from it. It has all the makings of demagoguery. But here I want to make sure that part of my theme is there's Donald Trump and then there's social unrest. And I was convinced that there are two separate issues, but after listening to yesterday, I'm not sure. Does Donald Trump's apocalyptic victory, as recently suggested in the London Review of Books article, mark the end of American exceptionalism, a certain idea of America as a model of democracy and freedom? Well, I have a fairly firm philosophy, such as any of my beliefs are firm, that things are never as bad as they seem, nor as good as they appear. America has neither an ideal political structure, nor does it represent a model of individual freedom. This election, with all of its populist extremes, does present a challenge to America, culturally, socially, and politically. The test of our Constitution is whether it can withstand shocks, such as that which we are now witnessing. Has and will Donald Trump and the group that he has aroused hijack those liberal ideals we so firmly feel rest in our Constitution? That's our issue. Americans on the surface are not consistent with what they believe. The historical moment is important, but I believe that contingencies are like rocks and beaver dams. Yes, the river has changed somewhat, but the main current is not, and it will wind out finally. Contingencies are detours unless something more fundamental happens. Go ahead. So, Trump, I believe, does not represent fundamental change, as is clear from the cabinet and set of advisors he is putting together. If anything, he's not draining the swamp, but simply putting more alligators into it. As Gillian Tett quoted the former mayor of New York, Michael Bloomberg, today, Michael Bloomberg, who detests Trump, I may say, what should executives do? One way is to respond is to heed the advice of Michael Bloomberg, former mayor of New York, and focus on what Mr. Trump actually does. As Mr. Bloomberg said this week, Mr. Trump has been on both sides of every issue and often backtracks as fast as he attacks. Nervous executives can thus console themselves by interpreting the tweets as a piece of populist flag waving designed to distract the media's attention from other issues. I suspect another crucial factor is that Mr. Trump is trying to assert his authority in an unfamiliar new landscape. I also want to note that being from the investment world, that the stock market, the market reflects underneath what the current is. And the stock market has gone up to newer and newer heights since Trump's election, not characteristic of an election of a populist president or the ascension of the people, not a breaking down of the system. I hope it's right. Nowhere is it more evident than in the United States, though, where we have, I went over that. The issue is whether Trump and his, I went over that too. Excuse me. That said, there are a number of disquieting elements that have no certain resolution. Trump has legitimated hate groups like no other American before him. And it is abundantly clear and unsettling, too, that social media with misinformation and lies believed significantly affected the election, I believe. We seem to have entered a post-truth political era. For good reason, there is uncertainty at home and abroad. What Trump has definitely proved is that we are not an exceptional or indispensable nation in the world. What does this mean, and how did it happen? A few months ago, Martin Wolf in the Financial Times wrote of the strain showing between the natural connection of the forces of capitalism and what he calls universal suffrage, civil, political, and personal rights. The latter, I believe, we are calling today the nature of liberal constitutions. The connection being the right to buy and sell goods, services, and one's own labor freely. We are entities to exercise agency. Humans must conceive of themselves as agents, not just objects to other people's power. Yet, he explains, there is tension between liberal values and capitalism. And when this gets out of balance, when the economy flounders and economic outcomes become too unequal, and economic outcomes are so often couched in social, cultural, and political terms, the majority, or at least a good number of them, might choose authoritarianism. Hence the current appeal in the US of Trump on the right and Bernie Sanders on the left. People feel angry and feel left out. As proof of that is that even in the setbacks from our recent recessions, burst bubbles, and vanishing industries in the United States, it has still pumped up significantly, even breathtakingly, with riches over the last 35 years. The real economy in that period of time has more than doubled in size. The government now uses approximately $5 trillion to help working families, old people, disabled, and unemployed people for housing, food, medical assistance, and education. Yet for half of all Americans, some 117 million adults, this growth has not reached them, not since the 1970s. Even after taxes and transfers, there has been a zero growth for working age adults in the bottom 50% of our working society. Wages for the bottom half, for instance, have gone from 20% of the slice of the pie to 12.5% from 1980 to 2014. Average income adjusted for inflation grew in the United States by 61% from 1980 to 2014. But nearly $7 of every $10 went to those in the top 10% in the income scale. All of this has been playing out in the United States, of course, in what we might view as a challenge to our liberal order and to our constitutional framework. But is it so irrational? We are seeing one of the greatest migrations in human history and the reaction to it. French and German right-wing movements focus on the same thing that Donald Trump does in declaring he will build a wall. That is a powerful appeal to people who feel disfranchised on many levels. Their grievances, as I just reflected in the economic numbers, are real. And there is this frustration at their government's apparent refusal to see this in the same perspective they do. The cultural challenge naturally accompanies it as well. When Gunnar Myrdal studied the race issues in the 1930s in the United States and wrote his famous book, An American Dilemma, he concluded that in the South, the one thing the poor white had was his race. Now that's under challenge in the United States in a broader sense than back then. For many Americans, there appears to be a threat to their definition of themselves on multiple fronts, and especially their dignity. The sense of loss on and Trump's appeal was well stated at a Trump rally during his campaign by one of the onlookers, apparently to no one as he viewed the audience. "Ah, this is it," he said, "the white working class America, the ones who are paying for all the others. Finally, we're getting someone who will do something for us. He will give us real change." For the past 30 years or so, our economy has become more efficient through technology and globalization, resulting, as I said, in an overall increase in the standard of living, but at the expense of certain segments of our society. The working class see their jobs disappear as companies outsourced and squeezed efficiencies in response to a ruthlessly competitive global market. And the government, regardless of the $7 trillion that they are spending, is perceived to have failed to adequately deal with this. Immigration is, in general, I believe, a positive force for both our economy and our society, but elements of our poor white community see it as a threat. Government is looking out for the interests of minorities and immigrants, the others, instead of their interests. Those who perceive themselves disfranchised see this as destroying as well the very nature of what our country stands for. And I'm reminded, and I think it was interesting, of the political slogans of our two candidates. Trump is "Make America Better Today," in many ways nativism, harking back to what we believe we are and who we are. And Hillary's was "Stronger Together." We are all minorities, she was saying. Let's hold hands, which didn't appeal to all of the downtrodden. Does Donald Trump's victory mark the end of American exceptionalism, as posited in the London Review of Books? I don't think so. But how did Trump seduce the American electorate? Trump's candidacy responded to many diverse groups and put together a coalition of voters. One, Tea Party people and traditional Republicans who were more interested in defeating Hillary Clinton. They hated her, than pursuing their well-known principles. The American electorate is historically restless, and 8 years of a presidency controlled by one party is all they can stand. We are not patient people. And Hillary is just another Obama, himself a president that many despised. After all, he's not really an American, is he? Voters, including amazingly a large number of women, wanted change and voted for a clear misogynist. Midwest blue-collar workers who reliably vote for Democratic candidates, but were angry at the Eastern elites controlling government who paid them no attention. And then there's the fringe, who have a fantasy that Trump would return the company to where borders mean something. White men are the natural leaders, and women and minorities know their place. Trump, the ultimate self-marketer, understood this. He knew his audience, and he told them what he wanted them to hear and what they wanted to hear from him. I don't believe Trump and the force of his coalition does represent a challenge to our foundation of the American political system. Perhaps an optimist, but I say this for a number of reasons. One, the coalition that brought him to the presidency is a disparate group, and it's not likely to hold together. Hillary, while extraordinarily qualified, was in the end not a strong candidate. Decades of attack on her during her 30 years in the political spotlight, and her own prominent mistakes, emails, speeches for $100,000 and the like, led the people to distrust her. And her public persona is not that of a warm, likable person. But she received 2.5 million votes more than did Trump. If we take 107,000 votes and sprinkle them among three states, Ohio, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, she would have been president, and I would not have been invited to this workshop. Watching him up close in business over the past 20 years, as I have, I think I know him fairly well, such as anyone can know him. He's told the people what they wanted to hear, much in the way he pursued his business interests. But when it comes to closing the transaction, he won't or can't close. A man of the moment, and as in his business dealings, he will not live up to the expectations of those who voted for him. He clearly forgets what he said yesterday today. The next 4 years will see him dealing with issues on a day-to-day basis, doing whatever strikes him at the moment, especially at 6 a.m. in the morning. Someone said shortly after, an airline consultant, after Trump's Twitter, or his tweet, I guess one is a Twitter and he tweets, about the cost of the next generation Air Force One that was being developed, "This is getting ridiculous fast when an important policy and acquisition decision is being made by Twitter." And especially the president-elect of the United States is worrying about a plane that he's never going to be used. That's never going to be used for him. He's transaction-oriented, a man of the moment, and he'll simply live not up to the expectations of those who voted for him. "No wall, perhaps," he now says, "some fence in areas." Okay, well, we're not going to export 12 million immigrants. We'll perhaps deport criminals, illegal criminals, a lot fewer. And on those items which he has no interest, which are many, or little knowledge, he will default to the conservatives. Default, not defer. Default, because he wants to maintain the support of the party that currently controls the American government. He has promised to drain the swamp, get rid of Wall Street and the political elites. So far, as we have said, he's done little. This week, the Wall Street Journal wondered whether, with moves scrambling definitions of right and left, Trump is opening the door to a post-ideological era. Post-truth politics, post-ideological era. And apparently, to my worry, in putting together his cabinet, his advisors, he seems to love generals. Well, do we see so far a challenge to our Constitution? Trump said if he did not win, he would challenge the result, challenge the Electoral College. He won, and there's no challenge. He said the first thing he would do if he won was to jail Hillary. That would be an arrogation to himself of powers he does not have in the Constitution. And instead of the first thing putting her in jail, he said, well, he won, and that was suffering enough for Hillary. No constitutional challenge. And if Hillary declared that the popular vote had made her the people's choice, she should be president, and denied Trump the right to be inaugurated, she too would have challenged the Constitution, but she did not. Well, what about, other than Trump, the constitutional challenge? Of great importance, more than Trump, is whether the populism, the social unrest, fueled by anger and distrust, and by use of excessive amounts of democracy, will alter the nature of our liberal constitution. Are we entering an age of post-liberal constitutionalism? I don't think so, not least in the United States. As Tony Judde pointed out in his final book, if you look at the history of nations that maximize the virtues of what we associate with democracy, you notice that what came first what's constitutionality. Then the rule of law and the ideals of the rule of law, the separation of powers, and then finally, if at all, democracy. Democracy always comes last. Certainly that aptly describes the U.S. Constitution. It is a representative constitution, a republic, not a democracy, which, and the Constitution can only be changed by an overwhelmingly supermajority. We have no referendum on the federal level. It aptly diffuses power, clearly defining the limits of the federal power, articulating rights of people, and recognizes the power remaining in the states. It provides for a strong legal system and an independent court that has balanced power off against the legislature and the executive. And these branches themselves are designed to compete as well as work with each other. The purpose of this Constitution is to provide a structure within which the people are governed by their representatives. It's not modeled for action, and it's clearly not democratic. It represents a republic designed to represent the people, but not to be controlled by the mob. As Dennis said last night, Madison, in his Federalist Paper number 10, sets out how the Constitution is to preclude action by what he called factions. Factions, of course, being mobs in large part. He says, by a faction, I understand a number of citizens, whether amounting to a majority or minority of the whole, who are united and actuated by some common impulse of passion or of interests adverse to the rights of other citizens or to the permanent and aggregate interests of the community. And he then designed, he and Hamilton, and discussed in the federal papers how the mob will not rule. And further to that point, to controlling the impulse of the people, is the establishment of the Electoral College, which, chosen by the people of each state, formally elects the president. Hamilton, in Federalist Paper number 68, clearly states that the purpose of this mechanism is to avoid undue influence of passion or corruptness by the people in choosing their chief executive officer. This mechanism today is archaic, to be sure, but the system now, currently, operates very effectively to assure the two-party system within which public agents must act and respond to. And even Trump recognized this. And I must say, although it only is reflective of a mood, and it will not change the Electoral College, a Republican elected to the Electoral College from Texas of all, which is related but not necessarily a part of the United States, has said that in spite of his being a lifelong Republican, he's not going to cast his electoral vote for him. For Trump, he just can't. When is a constitution deemed successful? One test is whether it is subject to strain or shock. Do the people yet demand conformance to the understandings and expectations set out in and implied by the Constitution? In general, I believe that there has developed over the some almost 250 years of our history, an internalization of the ideals by the people of our liberal constitution. That even in times when people are convinced that their opponents are determined to destroy their way of life, that the battle takes place within the confines of the constitutional structure. And history bears this out. Although we don't have time to go into it, to your fortune, William Jennings Bryan, the so-called Great Commoner, a true populist representing the angry people, which he mesmerized in 1896 during the Democratic Convention with his Gold of Cross speech, was ultimately defeated by the Central Core, represented by Teddy Roosevelt and the Progressives and the Progressive Program. And then Huey Long, the demagogic governor and then senator from Louisiana, popular in the 1930s with his program in the depths of the country's depression, to redistribute wealth and to rid the country of immigrants, nonetheless lost to Franklin Roosevelt and his New Deal programs. And I might point out, because it was Franklin Delano Roosevelt's name was brought up by Daniel yesterday, when Roosevelt was re-elected almost unanimously in the country in 1936, he tried to hurry along his progressive programs, his New Deal, by changing the vote of the Supreme Court, which was thwarting him. At that time, it was controlled by the conservative jurists. So he tried to pack the court, add additional Supreme Court justices to it. Now, I might say there's nothing unconstitutional about this, because the Constitution in the United States doesn't say how many people need to be on the Supreme Court. I must say, 8's not a good number, but 9 or 12 would be better. But the public and Congress rose up against Roosevelt and said, you have gone too far. This is not within our sense of our Constitution. In each case, both challenges to the liberal vision inherent in our political ideals and the Constitution, the central core, the people, demanded adherence to the mandate of our liberal Constitution. Thank you, Dennis.
Thank you, John.